Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
According to ZipRecruiter research, nearly three-quarters of employers say they're finding it difficult to fill open positions. 68% of employers have raised their wages. 23% have increased their benefits. If you have a difficult role to fill, no matter what your industry, hire with ZipRecruiter. And now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 top job sites. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. To try ZipRecruiter for free, my listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Good evening. The story raced across the news wires in 1966. Residents jumped in their cars and drove to Lake Summit to see the gruesome crime scene. On a late, hot July summer night in 1966, in a small North Carolina mountain town, the days-old bodies of 2 local men were found on a hillside overlooking a lake south of town. Nearby was a woman's body, a tire jack shoved into her genitals. Author Terrence Ryerson Neal discovered the crime in 2014, 48 years after it happened, and still unsolved. Now, the truth. The book that we're featuring this evening is the true story of the 1966 Hendersonville Triple Murders, Volume 1, The Confessions, 1966 to 1968. With my special guest, author Terrence Ryerson Neal. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. Terrence Ryerson
Neal.
Hello,
Dan. Hi.
Good evening. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining me. Let's talk about, first, you wrote about the Henderson triple murders, but it was a fictional book. Just tell us a little bit about this book that you wrote in 2016, 2017, called The Kills. Tell us a little bit about The Kills.
I wrote that book because a lot of the residents of the small town were really anxious to find out what I had discovered, but I was not ready to reveal the real names of the people involved. So I wrote this fictional version of the story to give everyone an idea what had happened, what had really happened, because they had never really heard the true story. But I did it in a fictional way. They could put the pieces together and get an idea of what was going on. And the great thing about the way I did it was that it not only made a good story, but everyone in town who read it said, I know exactly who you're talking about, regardless of the fact that I used a fictional name or a fictional location. So it achieved its purpose of basically buying me some time to finish writing the book with the actual names by supplying everybody with something to read in the interim.
Now, you write about your aim and your main goal in reconstructing these events through interviews and historical documents. What is the intention and the goal of this primarily?
Well, the crime itself was so intriguing to me when I first read it, and it was just by accident that I came across it. I was looking for something to write about, a true crime, and I thought I would pick something that was, old, unsolved, a very old cold case. So this one was nearly 50 years old, and so I selected it. Well, almost immediately after this, I started getting phone calls from people telling me to leave it alone, let it go. There are people still alive. You don't want to do this. I even had a reporter call me and tell me it was her story and I had no business getting involved in this. Well, that just raised the bar for me and said, I've got to look into this. And on top of that, the more I read about the story, like some accounts that had been written on the 40th anniversary, I just said to myself, there's no way that this can possibly have happened this way. For instance, the two men who were murdered who were gay, I believe that they were lovers, as we would have called them back then. They did not live together. Who were murdered? They were pictured in such a vile way in the 40th anniversary series that I knew personally that was just it didn't make sense. And there were lots of other red herrings and things like that. That the more I dove into this, I just decided I had to explore. I think the most important aspect of the story, though, that bugged me the most was that in the 40th anniversary series for the book of this murder, in 2006, that was written up in the local newspaper, it was alleged that an African-American man named Edward Thompson was actually the murderer. And the more I read about how they came to this conclusion, I just decided that this was another instance where probably a black man was being used as a scapegoat. And I just decided that if for no other reason than to find out if it was really true, that maybe I could do something to help show that he actually did not commit this crime, and discover who did commit the crime. So those were my, there's several goals in there, I realize that, but it was so intriguing that I just guess I wanted to solve all of them if I could.
Now you talk about the 40th anniversary special, and you talk about the program after that as well, with this involving the psychics. So, but yes. Tell us what was your first step? You talk about right in the book that there was so many people that helped you, but you talk about a person called Pick in the beginning, Pick 66, I believe, where you say he helped. So what was the first thing? What was the first break, or what was your first step in this investigation?
Well, I have to admit that even though I disagree with most of the stuff that I read in the 2006 40th anniversary series that was featured in the local Hendersonville, North Carolina newspaper, I have to admit that it was because of the fact that it was actually featured in the paper. I would probably have not explored this crime as much as I did. After reading that and discovering that, or figuring out that I just couldn't believe what I was reading, I actually placed an ad in a local newspaper called the Mountain Express in Asheville, North Carolina, which is nearby, and I put a picture of the woman, allegedly a picture of the woman who had been murdered, in with my ad. It was because of that ad that I started getting phone calls from people. And PIC 66, this source did not come along right away. I would say maybe it was 6 months later. But it was definitely because of the fact that this ad was placed initially. It raised awareness among the community that I was investigating the crime, and word got around to many, many people who began contacting me. And so I created my Facebook page called the 1966 Hendersonville Triple Murders, and that became actually a great landing spot for many of the people to kind of gather in a virtual room and discuss this with me, as well as do private messaging, almost like private messaging interviews. It was different for me to do this way, but I was discovering that technology actually offered a lot of benefits when it came to investigating the crime.
Let's talk about, before we get too far ahead here, let's talk about the summary of what was known at the time, what was reported in the time in 1966 of the crime itself, before we start talking and introducing characters. Tell us just a summary of what police could see at the outset and at the crime scene itself. How was it reported?
Well, that will be a little difficult to do precisely, because I do not believe that it was reported accurately by the police. And I do not believe that the local newspapers actually portrayed everything accurately either. What I discovered looking back is that newspapers outside of the general area of the small community in North Carolina were actually reporting details that was not being reported locally. So the exact details, as was reported initially, was that two men who ran a local music shop in Hendersonville, North Carolina, called Tempo Music, they essentially sold vinyl LPs. That was the primary business. They were very popular. And teenagers, they were very popular with teenagers. They were also gay. They were gay in 1966, which was a pretty unusual and pretty brave thing to do, because in 1966, even the American Psychological Association was calling being homosexual deviant behavior and bad. So to do this in a very small mountain town in North Carolina, where basically you did not have interstates, or they were being built, was a pretty brave thing to do. So these two men, 1 week in July, just didn't show up at the record store, and it didn't open. So the father of one of the men reported this, and it actually took about 2 or 3 days before anyone took them seriously. And then it began reported in the local newspaper, the two men are missing. That went on for 2 or 3 days, that there was a search for these two men. Nobody knew where they were. Of course, the rumor was that, well, they've just gone off somewhere and they'll be back. And then on a Sunday night in July of 1966, the local radio station reported over the air that the bodies of two men and someone else were found at Lake Summit. And literally, as soon as the residents of the small town, maybe 3,000 people in the entire area, they literally got in their cars and drove down to Lake Summit and walked all over the murder scene, or I'm calling it the murder scene, we'll call it the crime scene, but walked all over that scene and destroyed evidence and picked up things. And then it was just reported in the newspaper that these two men, Charles Glass and Vernon Shipman, their badly decomposed bodies were found on this hillside at Lake Summit, and nearby was what appeared to be the body of a woman. And the interesting thing about it was that you read the back cover of the book, my book, and you noted in there that she was defiled. A tire jack had been rammed up inside of her. That actually was not reported, and it was denied for many, many years. No one even wanted to admit that that was actually what they had found. And in fact, it had been removed by the police before people started showing up that night in July of 1966. So what the police found and what they reported were two entirely different things. And I guess right there is the great beginning of a wonderful mystery story, although it's a little macabre to call it a wonderful mystery story, but it sure set the tone for this one.
Now you talk about the county that...
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It was involved with. Tell us how police proceed in this investigation.
Well, the interesting thing about the way the police proceeded was that there was a sheriff in town who was an elected sheriff. And then there was a police chief in town. And almost immediately, however, there was this county of Henderson where there was this police chief, or Chief Powers, and the sheriff, Sheriff Hill. However, for some odd reason, the sheriff in a county nearby, Buncombe County, which is where Asheville is, Sheriff Clay, decided that he was going to take over the investigation because he said that the woman who was found nearby, the two men, had lived in Asheville, and he had jurisdiction over this crime that took place in Henderson County. Sheriff Hill was a fairly weak administrator and not... he was well-liked, but he was not considered a very good sheriff. And in fact, a few months later, he was voted out of office. He was a Republican, and 30 years of a Republican sheriff, and in November of that year, he was voted out of office, and the first Democratic sheriff was placed there. So because there was such a weak police presence in the area, it really gave Sheriff Clay the ability to just move in and take over. But of course, the one question is, what business do you have here doing this? But nobody seemed to be able to push him out of the way and to say, leave this alone. So it was strange, I would say, from the very beginning. Very strange as far as what the beliefs were doing.
Now, in this, just like any investigator, he has the ability to hire private investigators and hire anybody he wants and needs to be able to further this investigation. Who does he call, and what is the sort of premise for that call? How does it come to be that he has this eager person willing to help him, and who is it?
Well, and that's another very curious thing, too, is so you've got this crime that occurs in a small mountain town in North Carolina, and no one thinks too much about it, except maybe it's because these guys are gay and people are out to get him, and maybe it's the Ku Klux Klan, maybe it's somebody else. But the sheriff and the chief, they all have assistants, they have deputies, they have investigators. And yet, Sheriff Clay over in Buncombe County, who has his own set of investigators and things, calls a man in Miami. His name is Edward Stanton, and he deputizes Edward Stanton. Edward Stanton comes up to the area. Apparently, he spends 30 days in the area, although that's the fact that he is even in the area is not even reported by the local Hendersonville newspapers. It is reported in Asheville, but very little information is given about him. And he is deputized by Sheriff Clay. And then Sheriff Clay says that he sends Stanton back to Miami with all of his files, which is another very peculiar statement, because the first thing that I ask is, what files? And what is he doing with files for a crime that takes place in a neighboring county? And why is he giving them to a man from Miami? And why is this man taking them back to Miami? The other interesting thing about this is that Sheriff Clay gets away with all of this activity, and yet the State Bureau of Investigation, the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, comes into this crime, begins investigating, sets up an office nearby in a motel, sets up a special crime number, and according to other sources, the FBI comes in and begins investigating. But the only thing that I know so far about what the FBI did was that they built files on all of the homosexuals in town. And that's all I've been able to find. So far, the FBI says that they have destroyed the file. So that's all I know about that. But you have all of these agencies who have the authority to investigate and do all this stuff, and yet this guy from Miami pops up for some unknown reason, and then he disappears. And it's, again, just a complete mystery as to why this guy is there.
Now, they conduct their investigation, but they make no arrests. But then someone named Joe Henry Parham, this is 1968, so it's just a little ways away.
Right.
He's in a Lee County, Florida jail, possession
right.
of burglary tools, I believe. He passes a note to a jailer. Tell us about who Joe Henry Parham is and this note to the jailer and what it says.
Well, what we know now about Joe Henry Parham was that he actually had local connections. He was born just across the border in Spartanburg, South Carolina. His sisters lived in the area, and he had been an itinerant he had been a person who had worked in the farm fields of Henderson County, because they grew a lot of flowers back then. He had actually worked for a gladiola flower grower, and he had been in the area in 1966, as he had been for many other years working there. He was pretty much just a career goof-off. Basically, and the way he goofed off was to either work in the farm fields or to steal. So he was arrested. Lee County is Fort Myers, Florida, which is just on the other side of Florida from Miami. So you're pretty far south when you get to Fort Myers. And he was arrested when he was arrested with burglar tools, but apparently from what I've read, that charge was pretty weak, and he was not really going to be held very long. But he did pass a note to this man and at the jail, and he said, "I want to talk to an investigator." And I have a copy of the note. I published it in the book, and it actually is in his handwriting. So the investigator comes in and talks to him, and he says, "I killed Charles Glass." He says, "I'm the one who did it." And he gives him information, and that sets off a crazy chain reaction of events, having this man with a third grade education who works in the farm fields in Henderson County and lives in Fort Myers and gets arrested with burglary tools. It sets off this crazy chain of events 2 years later in 1966, after these murders occur, when he confesses to killing one of the gay men. So that's who he is. We don't know a lot about him other than that.
You talk about this confession, and it's one of four confessions, I believe. And this first confession, does he state any motive for killing Charles Glass? And then as a result of this one confession, what does Ed Stanton do?
So you've got Joe Henry Parham. He's sitting in the jail in Fort Myers, and he makes his confession to this investigator with the Lee County Sheriff's Office. So the Sheriff's Office calls Henderson County, and they confirm that sure enough, there was a murder in 1966, and yes, a man named Charles Glass was murdered. So immediately the people in Henderson County are very, very interested in learning more about Joe Henry Parham. Now, keep in mind also that in 1968, we've got a new sheriff in Henderson County. His name is James Kilpatrick. He was the Democrat that was elected. And James Kilpatrick has really decided that he wants to solve these murders. He wants to take charge, and he doesn't care about Sheriff Clay, even though Sheriff Clay has given him a hard time. He said, I really want to solve it. He was really happy to get this information about this guy down in Florida. So they immediately make plans to travel down to Fort Myers to talk to Joe Henry Parham. And yet, almost immediately after they receive word of what has happened in Fort Myers, in Hendersonville, they've received word. Suddenly, you've got, having never heard from him for 2 years, you've got Edward Stanton over in Miami who drives over to Fort Myers. Somehow he has heard already that Joe Henry Parham has made this confession. And not only that, but see, he's officially deputized by Buncombe County Sheriff Clay, so the Lee County people let him in, and we don't exactly know what Stanton talked with Joe Henry Parham about, but he spent 3 hours with him discussing whatever, this case, I guess. Now, it's true that, and then he left, and that's, we have some other documents that explain some things that he said, but he left, and then Sheriff Kilpatrick, or his deputy, actually, Deputy Investigator Neil Grissom, comes down first, and he interviews Joe Henry Parham. Now, I do have to make it clear, too, that it's interesting, almost immediately, again, by reading different newspapers, you get different views of what's actually going on. And Sheriff Kilpatrick has maintained, after several interviews with Parham, after he goes down, and also after they bring him back to Henderson County, which they do, because Joe Henry Parham waives extradition, Sheriff Kilpatrick maintains that Joe Henry Parham has been very consistent in everything that he has said about the crime and his role in it and what he has witnessed and what he has done. Interestingly enough, some of the documents that I have uncovered and also some of the news articles claim that Parham was just making up one story after another, how he went out drinking with Vernon Shipman and Charles Glass, and how he discovered they had money, and so they were at the lake south of town, and he saw this money, and he pulled his gun on him, and he shot him, and that was one story. And then another story, he's hitting him over the head, and there's all these different versions that supposedly Joe Henry Parham said, yet Sheriff Kilpatrick says, no, he's been very consistent in what he has told us, and he knows details about this crime that nobody else knows. So to be honest with you, I have to buy what Sheriff Kilpatrick says. But almost immediately after Joe Henry Parham, it's known that he has made this confession, and after Stanton has been there, Sheriff Clay goes on a tirade in the media, in the local newspapers of Asheville and Hendersonville and whoever else will listen to him, and says, they're all wrong. This guy may know something about this, but he had nothing to do. Sheriff Clay hasn't even talked to Parham. He doesn't even know anything about him yet, but he's already decided that this guy is a fruitcake and needs to be just ignored because he's just trying to get out of jail free. So, once again, you've got Parham saying all these things about what his motivations were and that he knew all these people and he just wanted to steal $340, which is supposedly all he got from them, and that was his reason for murdering three people. Of course, that's essentially ludicrous because we know that some of the facts that Parham is alleged to have said are totally inaccurate. But in his last confession, which we have, he pretty much nails exactly what really happened in this crime. And it's right there in black and white. So I have to wonder if Parham was playing a game with the investigators, which is possible because criminals will often negotiate with investigators, do a little dance around, here's what I know and here's what I don't know, and if you want to know more, I'll tell you this if you give me this. And so maybe he was doing that, or maybe the investigators, maybe some of the cops were dirty and maybe they were trying to cause Parham to be disbelieved by the general public so that the truth would not come out about what really happened with the triple murders. And I tend to be in the latter camp because I do believe that Joe Henry Parham did actually kill Charles Glass and that he was one of the participants in this crime. Yeah.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You're right, though, at the same time, to complicate this story more, or to complicate this case more, or to obfuscate, information, you have Edward Thompson, a black man, in the news at the same time. Tell us about what he's in the news for, and then, of course, what they believe he is guilty of.
Yeah, and it's funny that he suddenly gets drawn into this, because he doesn't get drawn into it until 1968. In 1966, Edward Thompson isn't even, he's not even a candidate for being involved in this. And in fact, on the cover of the book is a SBI, State Bureau of Investigation, sketch of a man who was allegedly in the car with the three victims, witnessed by at least two different people on the day that the bodies were discovered. That man has got short cropped hair, is white, and the pictures of Edward Thompson, who is black, don't even closely resemble that.
No.
Yet in 1968, when Parham makes this confession, what becomes apparent to me is that somebody doesn't want Parham talking, and they've got to find somebody to blame for this. So it is alleged that Edward Thompson has kidnapped a teenage couple in southern Henderson County in a place called Flat Rock, and that he raped the young girl, and then he kidnapped them, put them in the trunk of a car, took him to a spot someplace that is not identified, and where he dug up a bag of coins and then made these teenagers drive him all over Kingdom Come, until at which at one point he drops them off, leaves them, somehow he's injured, and then he disappears. Later on, it will be said that he also was responsible for kidnapping a doctor and his wife, for murdering a couple in two or three counties over in Virginia, and then also kidnapping three other girls. So Edward Thompson was an extremely busy man this one period in 1968 in March, all of which I don't believe he actually did, because when you read some of the other articles that are actually out about what happened, there is nothing that even closely, the descriptions, there are no, let's just say that, there is no physical description of who this alleged black man was that kidnapped this couple, the teenager. There is no description. And in fact, in one of the newspaper articles, it says that they were shown a very bad photograph of Edward Thompson. And they said, oh, well, yes, that's the man. Well, of course, it just was probably not true, because I went and looked up the court records on what these two teenagers actually said. Apparently, there is no statement from the girl saying that she was raped. Her father actually made the statement, but there is nothing on file from her. And it was actually the boy, the teenage boy, who said that the man performed oral sex on him. I don't even believe that Edward Thompson was anywhere near these two kids in 1968. I also don't believe that he was even any place near Hendersonville in 1966. I believe it was simply a matter of, and you would have to know the American South to understand this, is that all that a white girl had to do back in that, even as late as 1966, was to say, well, that's him, that black man over there. They could just pick somebody walking down the street. And if they wanted to accuse and point their finger at somebody and say, yeah, he did it, he raped me, that's all it took. And that man could be lynched because of that. And I honestly believe that that is what happened with Edward Thompson. They needed somebody to blame for the triple murders. So it was in 1968 that 2 years later, that the rumor became truth that Edward Thompson, the black man, was the man responsible for killing these three people, the two gay men and the woman, and leaving their bodies on the hillside in Lake Summit. So suddenly we have a completely new story that's circulating. And so the heat is off of, I guess you could say, Joe Henry Parham, because they basically do everything they can to discredit him. But so that's you're right. It gets very twisted and ugly, unfortunately.
So they eventually get to the point where they despite the confessions, despite some of the facts lining up that at least they believe, they've messed this up and they have to let him go. There are no charges against him.
You're right. And it's that's another strange thing, too, because in order to extradite Edward Thompson back to Henderson County, Sheriff Kilpatrick has got to present something to the local jurisdiction, and he does. And a man named Gilliam actually prepares the warrants and issues the orders to arrest him, and they go and get him and bring him back from Henderson County, or from Lee County in Florida, to Henderson County. So that's like 800 miles. And so there was sufficient information and evidence and reason to believe that Joe Henry Parham did this. And yet, within 2 months, they somehow went through a process of, first of all, they decided that Joe Henry Parham was suicidal. And so he was sent to a state hospital for evaluation. There's actually nothing that we read about Joe Henry Parham that indicates that he was ever suicidal, that he was ever mentally defective. He was not a very educated man, but he doesn't. He eventually is released by the state hospital, and they said there's nothing wrong with this guy. And yet, before the ink is dry on that letter, before it's actually even mailed from the state hospital in Raleigh, back in Hendersonville, 200 miles to the west, they've decided that there's no charges that they can bring against Joe Henry Parham. They've got to drop it, and they're going to release him. And just like that, he's out of jail.
And at the same time, there was no, other than the rumors, there was no attempt to arrest Edward Thompson for these murders.
That's the other interesting thing about this entire episode involving Edward Thompson, is that there was a lot of finger pointing and a lot of innuendo, and they started incredible conversations around town, and they implied that he was involved. He was never, ever even charged. He was never even interviewed. There's no interviews that I can find. And even if he was, there's nothing to prove that Edward Thompson was ever considered a suspect in these crimes. And actually, there's nothing. He was never brought up on any charges for kidnapping the doctor and his wife, the teenage couple. He was not extradited back to Virginia to stand trial for the murder of the couple there. And it's just extremely bizarre about how everyone had this idea that, yes, they finally caught him. It was a black man. Of course, it had to be, because this is the South and they're such horrible people. Thank God we've got him. Now we can put this crime to rest. But none of that was true. It was all a charade.
Now, at the same time, with this, not the same time, but in your investigation, one character that's very vital and, of course, important to the story is Louise Shumate.
Yes.
What did you find in your investigation about Louise? Because this is important, the depiction of Louise in this story as well as the investigation uncovered by police initially in 1966 that there could have been some kind of drug connection here, that Temple Music, they were selling some Yellow Jackets, amphetamine, some speed on the side. And, of course, as you mentioned, the 1966 idea of homosexuals being deviants and probably the source of all kinds of other problems because of that inherent criminality due to their homosexuality. Tell us what you find out about Louise Shoemate and what others, how they depicted the life of Louise Shoemate.
Sure, and I think that it's important to put that entire, like you said, put it all in perspective, because now we're saying, oh, it was because of them being homosexuals and they were selling drugs, and oh, of course, no reason they got in trouble and no reason all this happened. But putting it in context and understanding that Henderson County was a dry county at the time, there were lots of people in town who had liquor in their house, and they were holding little private parties and selling it. It was against the law. There were lots of parties going on around town that that I discovered when I doing all of my interviews, and there was a lot of reckless behavior. It wasn't just Charlie and Vernon who were the ones who were, I guess you would, we'll call it sinning, because a lot of the people in town, there's a lot of churches, and a lot of the people were good, upstanding citizens, but they were doing a lot of stuff the rest of the week that I guess they were confessing to on Sunday, but their lives weren't exactly as pure and as holy as they would like people to think. Louise was a very interesting character to research. Of course, that was the big question. Who was Louise Shoemate? Who was this woman found with these two gay men? And nobody in town seemed to even know who she was. To me, that should be the first tick thing that you tick off the box, is that, well, if they don't know who she is, and if she's not hanging around the music store, and you haven't seen her on the streets, then she may not have actually had anything to do with these guys. So, most people didn't like that idea, so they tried to connect her. But they said that Louise had an apartment in this place called the Ravenscroft Apartments in Asheville. So the first thing I did was I decided to look at what facts were presented about Louise. And so at the time, there were things called city directories. They were sort of like a phone book, but they were much more detailed. They would give you the name of the person, their address, what they did, and also would list all the people in the household and ages, too, sometimes. So I looked for Louise Shoemate. There is no record ever of Louise Shoemate ever living at these Ravenscroft's apartments in Asheville. Absolutely no record whatsoever. In fact, the last actual entry that I can find for Louise Shoemate of her actually even being alive is 1959, when she was living I can't remember the name of the road, but she had been living with her mother, and then she was living in another apartment, and she was working at a Bon Marché department store. And that's it, 1959. If you try to find an entry for Louise Shoemate any place else, there is none. So that should be a trigger, I would think, for anybody investigating this crime. But there were some very other strange things about Louise, and that was what I needed to figure out, is that were we actually talking about Louise Shoemate, or maybe this was somebody else? The reason I say that is because one of the very first things that I noticed that was odd was the death certificate for Louise Shoemate. Now, Social Security numbers were issued geographically back then. So wherever you lived, all you had to do was walk into a Social Security office, and that's where you would be assigned your Social Security number. And the numbers were assigned with a number that indicated what region you had signed up in. So Louise was born in Asheville, North Carolina, and the number for her Social Security number should begin with 2, like everyone else in the area. But the number on the death certificate said that Louise had a Social Security number that began with 034. And that indicated to me that she had gotten her certificate for her Social Security number somewhere in the Northeast. So I was able to narrow it down, and I was able to determine that allegedly Louise Shoemate, this Social Security number was acquired in a place called Lynn, L-Y-N-N, Massachusetts. So the next thing that would be obvious to me, so what happened was that when the 40th anniversary series came along, the way that the reporter justified this was she put a sentence in her story that said, oh, Louise and her husband, Francis Azell Shoemate, lived in Massachusetts for a short time. But there was nothing to substantiate that, so I began researching it. There is no record of Louise Shoemate ever having lived in Massachusetts at any time. There are records of her living in Asheville with her husband. There's a record of her living in Beckley, West Virginia, where her husband lived. He was a traveling salesman. I have a record of her living in Dallas, Texas, where she worked at Neiman Marcus for a short time in the late 40s. I have entries for her in Atlanta, where she worked in a department store there called Riches. I have the 1959 entry where she was working at Bon Marché. I have entries for her from the 1920s when she was living in Asheville. But I can't find any of these documents that other reporters have used to justify why Louise would have a Social Security number that begins with 0. She never lived in Massachusetts. There are no records to indicate that she ever lived there.
Right.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Honey. We all shop online a lot, but did you know you can make online shopping even better? You can with Honey. Honey is the free online shopping tool that saves you money online. Honey automatically finds the best promo codes and applies them to your cart, which makes online shopping finally feel as easy as it's supposed to be. When you check out, this little box drops down and all you have to do is click Apply Coupons. Wait a few seconds for it to scan for every promo code on the internet and watch the prices drop. I usually buy some books online, but my wife used Honey because she's signed up, and she got the Core Kitchen Beeswax Sandwich Wraps from Bed Bath & Beyond. For $19.99 was the regular price. She got 15% off, $3 saving. I got to say, every single time that I have tried to purchase anything through Honey, I've saved significantly. Every single time, every single purchase. And now my wife is enjoying the benefits of Honey as well. Honey has found its over 18 million members, over $2 billion in savings. Did you know Honey supports over 30,000 stores online and they're adding more every day? Not using Honey is literally passing up free money. It's free to use and installs in just a few seconds. Plus, it's backed by PayPal, so you know it's good. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/murder. That's joinhoney.com/murder. Now, just before this read for Honey, we were talking about Louise Shoemate and the mystery that is Louise Shoemate with no seemingly credible background to her. But let's talk about who you found in terms of her daughter, this daughter that everyone remarked that looked like her mother. Let's talk about her daughter, Christine, and her background.
Well, this is an interesting development in this entire story. Somehow I had to make sense of the fact that there was this woman with a social security number that began with zero. I had to make sense of the fact that I found medical records where even the doctor made a comment about a remarkably young-looking woman. And at the time that Louise would have been going to this doctor, it was 1951, she would have been in her late 40s, I believe. So I guess he would have been saying that he didn't say what age, but I would assume that he's talking at least 30. So, and everyone else, there were these comments and articles that you would read. She looked remarkably young. Louise was a remarkably young-looking woman. And I had to reconcile how Louise could be Louise, who could be 61 when she's murdered, who could have disappeared suddenly from the face of the earth in 1959, and figure out how this body came to be on this hillside, badly decomposed body. So the first thing I had to do was to, I was fortunate because I discovered that Louise had been living with a family in the 60s in Henderson, near Hendersonville, in an area near Horseshoe, North Carolina, which is just right outside Hendersonville, and that Louise had been very ill, and the people that I interviewed, I'm not going to answer any names right now, but they indicated that Louise was quite ill, and that she had her own room in the back of the house, and that's where she stayed most of the time. And the first thing I thought, well, this makes absolute sense to me. Here's a woman who, in 1951, had surgery. She had cancer on her breast. 1959, she's working in a Bon Marché department store. She suddenly just doesn't have an address anymore. Well, it would make sense that, okay, she's gone to live with this family, a friend that she met in 1931. Okay, fine. Louise is 61. She's old. She has cancer. She's a smoker. She's living with this family. So why are they saying that she is at the Ravenscroft Apartments? I don't quite understand. So I had to look back further, and I had to figure out, there were rumors. There was a lot of talk about the woman having a daughter. But no one ever would name her. It was just this little tagline that came up in stories about this. So what I discovered is that Louise Shoemate actually went by her first name, Opal, and her maiden name, Davis. In 1916, she was a student, and then suddenly she wasn't a student anymore. She sort of just disappeared. And then she shows up in 1922 in a city directory, and it says she's a trained nurse, and now she's using her name, Louise Davis. The first thing that struck me is that to be a nurse, you need training, and you probably need to graduate high school. So I verified all that, verified that it would not have been possible for Louise to have become a trained nurse in 2 years. And why in the world would she have dropped out of high school? Because there's no record of her ever graduating. The logical explanation for that is, as would be appropriate for back in that time, is that she became pregnant and she had a child, and she then began working at department stores. She had this one entry for when she was a nurse, and she then started working at department stores. So she obviously had this child. She married Azel Shoemate 10 years later in Asheville. And then 5 years later, Azel's living in Asheville with his daughter, Christina, and Louise is not there, and that's because it's starting this time when they're on the outs. They actually get divorced in 1942. So my first thought was, well, Christine is is the reason that Louise dropped out of high school. Christine is the daughter living with her father in Asheville, and probably her mother, who's just not recorded there at the time. So it's pretty obvious that Louise has had this daughter. So then I do a little more research, and I discover Azel has a will, and he names these children he has with his second wife after he divorces Louise in 1942, but then he names Christine. And he gives these other children a few things, but he gives Christine all of these oil rights and things like, and it's like, Christine is obviously extremely special to him for some reason. So I'm able to research and discover that Christine actually was born, that then she went to live with Azel in West Virginia. He got divorced from his wife then. So, you know, these are the kind of things that you put together by sometimes not by exact roots, but by the pieces of the puzzle around the entire thing, so you can see the big picture. And it would make sense then that Louise may have gotten ill, but also that there might be a reason that Christine might be sick too. And in fact, Christine does die in 1970, incidentally. So she's very young when she dies. Mm-hmm. So Christine is probably sick too, but she was probably the one. Christine was probably the one who went to the hospital in Asheville, who had the surgery on her breast cancer, and who was pretending to be her mother. She was probably using her mother's name because her mother had insurance. So that would make perfect sense to me. Her mother's in Atlanta. Christine goes to the hospital in Asheville. She has the surgery. The doctor makes a reference about Louise, who was born in 1904, being mysteriously young-looking. And, of course, she's not mysteriously young-looking. She is. She's not Louise. She's Christine pretending to be her mother because she has insurance, and that's how she's going to pay for this. So that all makes perfectly good sense. But how to reconcile the 1960s? So what happens when Louise disappears? Well, Louise goes to live with this family because Louise is ill too. She's a smoker. She's 1961. She's lived a fairly hard life of working on her feet for decades in department stores, and now she's extremely ill. And Christine is still around town, but then there's this Ravenscroft issue. Well, the people who told me about Louise living at the farm told me also that Louise would give them hair permanence. There were these, you know, girls would get permanence, very tight curls and things like that. Now, when you're young, you sort of mix up people that sometimes you get involved with. And I'm thinking, well, why would Louise, who was very sick, be giving a permanence? And all this, and then I discovered that that Louise allegedly had this very good friend. Her name was Hazel McNeil. Hazel was a hairdresser, and Hazel had a first floor apartment at the Ravenscroft Apartments. Well, suddenly I'm beginning to think, now this is making sense. It wasn't Louise who was giving these girls a permanence. They were young. They just got the person wrong. It was Hazel who was visiting Louise with Christine, the daughter, and then Joe Henry Parham suddenly, when I discover this information about him, he says, "Oh yeah, I went to see Mrs. Shoemate at the Ravenscroft Apartments, and I went there once and got a shot of morphine for $5." And I'm thinking, but Louise Shoemate never lived at the Ravenscroft Apartments, but Hazel did that entire time. Oh, wait a minute. He went to Hazel's apartment. He just thought it was Louise's apartment. And maybe Christine was still ill, and maybe she was getting morphine, but more likely they were probably taking some of Louise's morphine that she was using to keep herself sedated, and they were taking it back to the apartment, and they were passing out shots for $5 a pop. And they got to know Charlie and Vernon because they were gay, and there was a gay bar downstairs, not far away from the Ravenscroft apartments. Everything was finally falling into place, and it made perfectly good sense that Louise and Christine looked enough alike that sometimes Christine would pretend to be Louise, but when she did, people would remark about how remarkably young she looked. Well, it was Christine who was remarkably young at the time. It wasn't Louise. So it suddenly just all made perfectly good logical sense how the rumors, the innuendos, actually did fit into this fairly seamless series of events of people just living their lives and doing things that people do every day. And I could prove it all. I could prove every bit of it. I didn't have any proof for the stuff that people thought they believed, but I had lots of proof for the stuff that made sense about what was going on.
Let's talk about the boyfriend that she meets and how serious that relation gets and what she receives from him. Tell us about this boyfriend.
Well, and I think that you'll need to understand, and I am going to give one tiny little thing away, but it is excruciatingly important that you understand that there is a person in Hendersonville to this day, a living person, who walks around town with a little box, and he takes a great deal of pride in it. And when he brings it out and shows it to people and takes the lid off, he says, "This is the finger of the woman who was found murdered in 1966. Well, yes. What in the world is this man doing with this finger? Mm-hmm. Well, so it took me a long time to figure this part out, because there were a series of events that took place in the United States and the world for the previous 2 years. In 1964, there was a major robbery in New York of the Natural History Museum. A guy named Murfleser, Jack Murphy, Alan Kuhn, and another guy, apparently they climbed in through some windows at the Natural History Museum late at night. They were just open, and went in and cracked all the glass display cases and stole bunches of jewels and gems, including the Star Sapphire India, the DeLong Ruby, something called the American Eagle Diamond, which was the largest uncut diamond ever found in the United States at the time. It had been found in Wisconsin. And then they ran off to Miami. Well, so in 1965, these guys are caught. And things are worked out so that they will give back or tell people how to get back some of the jewels that they stole. And to make a long story short, guess who was involved in helping do the recovery? Edward Stanton, our mysterious private investigator from Miami, who is good buddies with Sheriff Clay, who shows up in Hendersonville. And, of course, by now I'm like scratching my head, wait a minute, this is becoming way too crazy. I've got a private investigator from Miami who doesn't make any sense why he's involved in a small town murder, a guy who gets involved in helping the New York Police Department recover gems that were stolen from a museum. And what in the world is he doing in Hendersonville trying to solve this crime? But also, what in the world is he doing getting involved in these gems and things like that? There is one drop where they try to recover some of the gems that actually fails. And again, to make a long story short, not all of the gems are ever recovered. Two of the most important ones, the DeLong Ruby and the Star Sapphire India, are recovered. But the Eagle Diamond is not recovered. And the Eagle Diamond is, they believe that it was, and probably rightly so, it was a raw, uncut diamond. They believe that it was probably sold off and it was cut into smaller jewels, and nobody would ever be able to figure out what had happened to it. Well, okay, so I've got these holes in my story, and somehow I've got to figure out why Edward Stanton is involved in a crime in a little tiny mountain town, but also he's involved with these recovery of these jewels. And researching a little bit more about this small town of Hendersonville, and honestly, I think Jessica Fletcher would love this small town because I've never seen so much stuff going on in Henderson County. The year before the triple murders, this man was arrested. His name was Harry Henry Sittner, and he was living in a motel, and when he was arrested, he was using five aliases. One of them was a real estate developer. There were other aliases that he was using. And he was recovered with like well over $100,000 worth of precious gems. Come to find out, Harry Henry Sittner, in my research, was a very famous international jewel thief who used various aliases, had been in prison, prided himself on never having a gun. But he had also set up a counterfeiting ring using some of the money from some gems that he had stolen down the way. And he set this up in Saluda, North Carolina, down the road, and it was very sophisticated. They were manufacturing very good $20 bills until they were caught. And that was actually right. How they discovered Harry with all these gems, because he had financed it all. So we've got Harry, and we've got Edward Stanton, and we've got Jules, and we've got Louise, and her finger's been cut off, and this tire iron is shoved up inside of her. And the most obvious solution to this is that Harry Henry Sittner, who was a ladies' man, he had multiple wives all over the country, children all over the country. Harry had, as I discovered, had gotten a hold of the Eagle Diamond, and he had gotten a hold of this because Edward Stanton's wife, who he was on the outs with, and who was part of the failed gem recovery, the first drop, and I've actually got pictures of her, the back of her head sitting in her Cadillac in a parking lot in Life magazine. So this is all true. She just disappears. Well, she disappeared with the Eagle Diamond, and she took it to Harry. Harry knew how to cut diamonds, but he also knew people who could do the cutting for the diamonds that were very important, and he wasn't very confident with those. And the Eagle Diamond got cut, and he and Christine, he developed a relationship with Christine Shoemate. She was a fairly wild child, and he was a pretty wild person too. And they developed a relationship. He gave her an engagement ring. The engagement ring was one of the diamonds cut from the Eagle Diamond. When it was discovered that the diamond had been taken, somebody in South Miami, and I'm not going to go into who that is now, but I do think I know who that was, decided that they wanted it back. It was theirs, they decided, and that's why Edward Stanton was suddenly involved. He had discovered that Harry was up there. He had discovered that Harry probably... Well, he had been found with all these gems. Harry was probably the one who had the Eagle Diamond. And sure enough, when they got up here, a grand switcheroo took place. And you can read the book to discover exactly how it happened. But when Louise Shoemate was confronted by Edward Stanton, not Edward Stanton, but a man that he hired named Lawton Gay. She had the ring that Harry had given to Christine on her finger, and that was all Lawton Gay needed to know. That was the ring he was looking for. That was the diamond that he wanted. So they hauled Louise out of the bedroom of that farm. The man who owned the farm took Louise's car and parked it out near the river and left it there. And Louise was discovered a few days later, dead, her skull cracked open, her finger cut off, because they couldn't have gotten the ring off because her hands were so swollen, a tire iron pushed up inside of her, because what Lawton Gay didn't realize, he thought that Louise was actually Edward Stanton's wife who had gone missing. So he did that because he wanted to get back at her for leaving his friend, Edward Stanton. It was a mistake, and it wouldn't have happened if he had known the truth about it. But they recovered the stone, and they were left to believe that Louise Shoemate was there for some unknown reason that nobody will ever figure out. And they went out of their way to make sure that nobody did, and they covered it up, and they kept covering it up. And when Joe Henry Parham confessed, they kept covering it up. They just didn't count on me coming along, I'm afraid.
So. Now, what is the horrible truth about Christine? She hears things in the small community. Again, she's conducted herself. She's had a real wild life so far, and dealing with nefarious people. What is the horrible secret about what she hears, and what does she put into play, given the advice from her friends?
Christine, she does not have a death wish. Harry has been arrested. Harry has been sent to prison for the counterfeiting scheme and the stealing of the jewels. And so she still got this ring, and she's going about her life. And all of a sudden, Vernon and Charlie go missing this week in July of 1966. And then suddenly there's these stories that she's hearing about how they're looking for the woman and her ring. And she realizes somehow, she comes to the conclusion that they are looking for her. The name Christine apparently does come up in some of the stories that are repeated to her. And she realizes that this ring on her finger may be more valuable than she realizes it ever was. And so she decides that... Her friends talk to her, and of course she makes a decision that if these people want her, somebody's going to have to be sacrificed or she's going to be dead, because she has something that they want. So they hatch this plan that because her mother is so ill, that it would make more sense that her mother should die rather than her. So they go out to the farm. Her mother's got her morphine there. They shoot her up with the morphine. Christina puts her ring on her mother, Louise's finger, so that they'll see the diamond. She goes through the purse. She exchanges identifications, including hers. Because, see, Christine had lived in Massachusetts at one time. I'm not exactly sure why or when, but there is a driver's license that is discovered with the body that says Claremont Terrace. Now, the police tell us that it's Hendersonville, but there is no Claremont Terrace in Hendersonville. But there is a Claremont Terrace in Lynn, Massachusetts. And that's where the Social Security number, starting with 034, was issued. That's the one that's on the death certificate. So all of Christina's identification goes with Louise. Louise or Christine takes all of Louise's identification, and when Lawton Gay comes out, he doesn't know the difference. He's never seen this person before. He just knows he's looking for a sort of remarkably young but a woman who has a ring on, and he's supposed to get her and do what he has to get the ring back. So Christine basically sacrifices her mother in order to live, and that's what happens. Louise is killed.
Yeah. Incredible.
Now, in this story as well, along the way in this is painstaking for you to get to this point, to get to this part of the investigation where you find out this incredible information about her daughter and the motive and the reason behind this entire murder. Along the way, you provide all kinds of source documents to back up this, and slowly but surely you reveal what we just mentioned in this interview, but also that very interesting is this confession, and the people that are at this confession have nothing to do with law enforcement. Just to corroborate some of the claims that you make and some of the statements by other people, you put this together, and you have things like the W.J. Burgess confession where he goes to he's a witness to these murders, or before the murders. Well, tell us a little bit about J.W. Burgess,
yeah,
and also what the niece heard from her aunt talking to her brother that night, which was Burgess.
Yeah, and the niece, they are awakened at a knock pounding, actually, at the door, and her mother goes to the door, opens it, and the mother's brother, this niece's uncle, is standing there, and he's covered with blood, and her mother just goes crazy. It's like, oh my God, oh my God, and he comes in, and at this point, all the children, the three children, are awake, and they're listening as Burgess goes into this story, telling about how the triple murders just took place, and who was there. And names of people that were assisting or who got involved and helped move the bodies from this one location, because the murders did not take place at the lake. The murders took place at a motel place called Sheva's Cottages. And he details to his mother what's happened, and he's scared to death because he has participated in this, and he got drawn into it, and he helped move the bodies, and now he's going to leave town. So the niece writes all this down later, and she gives the notebook to me, actually, the notebook of recapping that, and I've got much more that I will eventually reveal when I can, but it's essentially a confession as told to, as overheard. Now, I can't use that necessarily as a main source of proving something, but what's curious about it is that it corroborates what Joe Henry Parham says. And what's even particularly interesting is in Burgess's confession, he names a guy named Donnie Case. And in Joe Henry Parham's confessions, the police list Donnie Case as someone who is witnessing Joe Henry Parham's confessions. But Donnie Case is not part of law enforcement. He's a hoodlum. He's a crook. He's a criminal. And yet he and two other guys, one Frank Franklin, I forget the other guy's name, are there witnessing Joe Henry Parham confess to killing Charlie Glass. And Donnie Case and this other guy, according to J.W. Burgess, were part of the crime. So I have corroboration now that tells me that the crime did indeed take place at Sheva's Cottages, that the bodies were moved, that a vehicle. Sheriff Kilpatrick says a vehicle from Wildwood, Florida. All of the stuff that I've been told by sources about this man from Wildwood, Florida, who I know now works with Edward Stanton carry out this crime. Everything is corroborated by various confessions. So what I had initially was lots of proof, but I didn't have enough to tie it all together. But when I began to get these confessions, I began to get the information that corroborated everything and proved that what had happened in 1966 wasn't anything like what the police or the newspapers reported to the general public 54 years ago. Totally different crime that's been covered up for all this time.
Now, you name this person, this truck driver from Florida, in this book, but I've got to ask you, as this interview winds down, this is the volume one of this. So what are the plans for the continuance of this story? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I have to tell you that I'm fortunate that I have basically a story that's similar to a Thornbirds saga, or a book about like Hawaii that James Michener wrote. Hundreds and hundreds of pages of characters and things that all came together and did all that. And so what this truck driver turned out to be, and he was actually, he was named to me by one of my sources, but I did not have the proof that he was involved in this, because this truck driver, his name was Lawton Gay. He was actually much, much more than a truck driver. That's just how law enforcement knew him. But he was probably one of the most horrible men that I've ever come across. He may be one of the worst criminals that has ever lived that nobody knows anything about. And so I think I say in my book that he may be looking up at me from his home in internal hell, taking pride in me placing him in the annals of crime, but so be it. I think he deserves to be vilified. And I have, you know, resources that tell me some of the crimes that he does, but I have a feeling that most of the crime that Lawton Gay ever did or took place, we'll never know. But he was involved with organized crime. The list goes on and on. So basically what my plan is to, this book focuses on 2 years, 1966 to 68. I'm going to then focus on a period from 1982 to 86, because I received FBI files for Lawton Gay and some of the other crimes that he took place in, which was particularly awful, and then go back and start building up the story from the beginning, like in 1900, when Louise's father goes to work at the Biltmore Estate in Asheville for George Vanderbilt, and her being born, and everything that kind of her life, and then branching off into Charlie's life and Vernon Shipman's life, and how all these characters had lives that merged in 1966. And then after that, beyond that, what happened to them afterwards, because I have to tell you that Harry Henry Sittner, Edward Stanton, Lawton Gay, their lives were just as interesting and crazy after this crime as they were in 1966. And it's a fascinating story, and I'm really looking forward to telling everybody more about it.
Absolutely. We'll be certain to have you back on and tell the continuing story of this, the true story of the 1966 Hendersonville triple murders. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this book, the 1966 Hendersonville Triple Murders. For those people that might want to take a look and purchase this book, as we talked about in the beginning, tell them how they might be able to go to this specific book, because, as you explained,
You did initially put out another book that's not available right now. So for people to want to get this book, The True Story of the 1966 Hendersonville Triple Murders, tell us about the Facebook page that they can go to be able to take a look
sure.
at this book.
Yeah, I've got a Facebook page. It's 1966 Hendersonville Triple Murders. And the Facebook address, I guess, is at 1966 Hendersonville, NC for North Carolina. So they can go there and they can click on the link that takes you to where you can find the book on Amazon. Unfortunately, it hadn't got out into the bookstores, and because of our pandemic right now, that may be a little mm-hmm. while. People can also, if they wish, they can email me at terryneal@gmail.com, and that's terryneal@gmail.com. And if you are on Amazon, I think probably the best way to find it is just to type in my name, Terrence Ryerson Neal. It's TerranceNee, and then Ryerson is RYerson, and last name Neal, NEAL. So there's three ways, and hopefully if you can't find it, you can still contact me through the Facebook page or the email address.
Well, thank you very much for coming on and talking about the true story of the 1966 Henderson Triple Murders, and we look forward to the next volume of this with anticipation. Thank you very much, Terrence Ryerson Neal. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, and you have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan.